Green Valley News for Wednesday, December 17th. Mark DeGroft with you. Pima County supervisors pulled a proposed ordinance from Tuesday's agenda that would have added additional restrictions on paved roads with an eye on Santa Rita Road, the primary route for heavy-duty trucks hauling material from the proposed Copper World Mine east of Suarita. The Board of Supervisors okayed a motion 4-0 by Chair Rex Scott to close the public hearing on the proposal and have it pulled from the agenda following an executive session. Supervisor Matt Hines, attending remotely, didn't respond during the roll call vote. Executive sessions are closed-door meetings permissible under state law to discuss contracts, legal, and personal matters. Supervisor Jen Allen said on Tuesday that the county could come back and accomplish the ordinance's goals of protecting air quality. No other supervisor commented on Scott's motion. Scott told a packed room that if anybody submitted a card to address the item, that they would no longer have anyone to speak to, but they could still speak during the general call to the public. He added that anybody there solely for the item could leave, and more than 65 people did just that. Tuesday would have marked the continuation of the ordinance hearing that began on December 2nd when a dozen people representing mine owner Hood Bay Minerals, along with trade and commerce groups, opposed the proposal. The ordinance would have set a 15-mile-per-hour speed limit and restricted heavy-duty trucks to 75 trips daily on unpaved roads. County Administrator Jan Lesher told supervisors in a November 12th memo that the ordinance was in response to concerns over dust pollution that would be raised by Save the Scenic Santa Rita Association, an activist group opposed to Copper World. Michael Mick Rusing from Rusing Lopez Lazardi and Saffer Law Firm, who is representing Copper World, said the December 2nd portion of the hearing that the ordinance was illegal because it targets a single entity. The December 2nd part of the hearing didn't have the ordinance support turnout that the opposition did. SSSR Executive Director John Doherty told supervisors at the time that there was strong support across multiple environmental groups, adding they didn't show up at the time since they thought the hearing was still 2 weeks away. Supervisors had planned to hold off the ordinance for another 2 weeks on December 2nd, but Supervisor Steve Christie asked for it to be on both days as it was a last-minute decision and people opposing the ordinance had taken time to speak to it that day. The Pima County Attorney's Office made the request to push the item from the December 2nd meeting. Chief Civil Deputy Attorney Sam Brown told the board there was a lot of public feedback and that the attorney's office wanted to reassess whether any revisions are necessary. This article is from the editor. It's time for Silent Juan to speak up. President Trump's cruel, self-centered comments on the deaths of actor-director Rob Reiner and his wife Michelle Singer Reiner, disgusting even by his bottom feeder standards, have prompted a handful of decent Republicans in Congress to speak up. It's not the overwhelming GOP blowback that the national media makes it out to be, but it's something. Here's some of what we've heard and what we haven't. Representative John Kennedy, Republican out of Louisiana, a wise man once said nothing. Why? Because he's a wise man. I think Trump should have said nothing. Representative Don Bacon, Republican, Nebraska, I'd expect to hear something like this from a drunk guy at a bar, not the President of the United States. Representative Thomas Massey, Republican out of Kentucky, regardless of how you felt about Rob Reiner, this is inappropriate and disrespectful discourse about a man who was just brutally murdered. Guess my elected GOP colleagues, the VP and the White House staff, will just ignore because they're afraid? I challenge anybody to defend it. Representative Juan Ciscomani, Republican of Arizona, nothing. That last one is no surprise. Silent Juan, as he's increasingly known, is somewhat somewhere in Washington with his finger in the air trying to figure out which way the wind is blowing. For now, he'll let it slide because he lets a lot of things slide. Like the facts that tariffs are killing businesses, the economy is crumbling, and that Ciscomani's patron saint, Donald Trump, has pardoned a veritable rogues gallery of men and women. They include U.S. Representative Henry Cuellar and his wife Imelda, accused of taking bribes from foreign companies. Representative George Santos, who defrauded constituents and just about everybody else on the planet. Former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, sentenced to 45 years in prison for drug trafficking, and commuted the sentence of David Gentile, convicted of a $1.6 billion financial fraud, and served just 2 weeks of a 7-year sentence. Changpeng Zhao, a Chinese felon who the U.S. Justice Department said did significant harm to the United States' national security. Trump said he didn't know Zhao, but reporters have discovered they had business ties that enriched the Trump family. This doesn't scratch the surface, but Soleimani is being consistent, remains silent. But what is he out there talking about? Well, he recently published an editorial with the headline, "Keeping My Commitment to Arizona's Rural Veterans." Only two problems with it. First, in a show of disregard for local veterans, Soleimani initially published the editorial in the Washington Times, over 2,000 miles from his southern Arizona congressional district. Last I heard, nobody in Washington votes in CD6. Only then did he hand it out to local media and veterans like scraps to a dog. Second, he doesn't mention the 35,000 VA healthcare positions that the administration is cutting, or the 30,000 VA jobs it cut last summer. But hey, Juan's all for veterans. We'll publish his editorial as soon as his crack communications staff sends it our way. And why haven't they? We can only guess, since Soleimani and his team have completely shut down on Green Valley and its 90% voter turnout. They're likely afraid we'll fact-check it, as we did his specious claims that Big Beautiful Bill was good for business while ignoring devastating tariffs. But Representative Soleimani has got bigger problems. He's in a highly competitive district, and already we're seeing reasons to compare the 2026 midterms to 2006, when Republicans lost control of Congress, governorships, and state legislatures. It was a shellacking right down the middle of President George W. Bush's second term. And here's why it happened, and note the comparisons to today. Bush's popularity was flagging, Trump's approval ratings are dropping even among the MAGA faithful. Voters weren't happy with how Bush was handling big issues in 2006, including the Iraq War, compared to Venezuela, Ukraine, and Russia, scandals involving fellow Republicans, see pardons above, and GOP policies in general in 2006 that were wearing thin. Today, think of DOGE, tariffs, ignoring due process, murdering people on the high seas, travel bans, etc. Add this to a president who can barely speak a sentence without lying, and we have a pretty rough year coming up for the Republicans. Soleimani has two choices: continue to ignore reality while remaining aligned with a deeply unpopular and unethical president, or reclaim himself, be the freshman leader voters picked in 2022, the guy who wasn't afraid of the folly of the Biden administration and who put his country and constituents before anything else. That Juan has lost his way and his loyalty to a president who doesn't deserve it is the reason. Try being your own man again, Congressman. We don't recognize the one we see now. And that was written by the editor, Dan Cheer. Three Sorita residents are among the winners of the Arizona Department of Homeland Security's Kids Safe Online Cybersecurity Awareness Calendar Contest. K-12 students across Arizona were invited to participate in the contest, which was designed to promote essential online safety and cybersecurity awareness. The calendar contest provided students with an opportunity to creatively share their knowledge and contribute to a safer digital community. Secure Your Space, a piece created by Sophia Coons, a second grader at Suarita Digital Pathways Academy, was selected for May. No Hackers, a piece by Shafia Stewart, a fifth grader from the academy, was selected for June. And Alexa Brown, a sixth grader down the trail, will have her creation, No to Hackers, featured in November. The Suarita Unified School District has chosen their Teachers of the Year for each of their schools, and they are Elizabeth Richardson at Saguaro Digital Pathways Academy, 6 through 12 math, Matthew Kramer, Suarita Intermediate School in PE, Amanda Kiesenberry, Suarita Primary School K, Callie Smith, Anza Trail School, 4th grade, Yolanda Serbanuk, Anza Trail School, MS Language Arts, Derek Keininger, Suarita High School, Social Studies, Stephanie Drew, Copperview Elementary School, 5th grade, Diana Villa, Wrightstown Ridge School, MS STEM, Brittany DeFazio, Wrightstown Ridge School, 1st grade, Vanessa Velarde, Walden Grove High School, Science, Wendy Fairbanks, Suarita Middle School, 6th grade Science, and Jonna Turner, Sapori Reading Specialist. And first grade teacher's aide Rachel Grijalva and ACE aide Cindy Lynn Olliman were selected as Wrightstown Ridge's High School's, or School's, 2025-26 Support Staff of the Year. Barbara Simcoe has been painting for more than 50 years, but her most recent undertaking is a desert masterpiece on the oddest of canvases, a chair. Simcoe, 75 years old, has been painting since third grade. After sustaining a leg injury around the age of 5, it kind of kept me out of action for most of my K through 12 education, she said. I went to school, but I just didn't get into sports or anything, so I kind of went internal and picked up a pencil. And I had an aunt who painted, and she introduced me to painting, and I just did it all through high school. After high school, Simcoe attended a community college in her hometown of Corning, New York, before moving on to a bachelor's degree in art education from the State University of New York at New Paltz. Simcoe intended to become an art teacher, but instead had a 25-year career in workforce development in California, painting in her spare time. It wasn't until retiring in Arizona 10 years ago that she picked up the paintbrush more frequently. "It's been really since then I've been painting a lot," she said. "And more recently, I've been doing things to kind of give back to my community." Simcoe spends time as a coordinator of a day club in Rancho Resort, teaching hand building and glazing, drawing and painting classes once a week, and hosting occasional paint and sip events with painting and wine. Then about a month ago, inspiration for a new project struck. A friend of ours from Rancho Resort, who had moved in recently, was kind of getting all her stuff together, and she had these two wing chairs, and she didn't want both of them, didn't have room for both of them, Simcoe said. "So I just had it in my head. I'd see these other people who had painted on chairs, and I thought that maybe that could be fun. So I got it from her, and then I started painting." She had painted a fabric chair once before, but never to this extent. "I painted it all in one color, and I didn't paint it fancy. It was just to change the color and kind of give it a new look," she said. "But I have never really painted one this way or graphically like this one." Despite some work in still lifes, portraits, and her pet portraits, Simcoe's focus and passion lies with landscapes, especially Sonoran landscapes, as a Northeasterner living in the Southwest. "I used to do a plein air landscape painting as part of a Sonoran plein air group for a while, and I love it. It's a spiritual thing for me to be outside and painting outside," she said. "It's wonderful. I love being out and doing landscapes, so I take pictures wherever I go." It was pictures from a trip to Picacho's Peak State Park a couple of years ago with her daughter Heather that Simcoe got the inspiration for the unique canvas. "I took a bunch of pictures, and it was one of those seasons where the wildflowers were out, so I thought I want this to kind of be a Southwestern chair. I love the peak and the mountains and then the saguaro," she said. "This was not just from one picture, it was from a couple, and kind of a composite. I wanted the foreground, which ended up being the seed, of course, to be some bright flowers like the California poppies." Typically, a large work on average canvas only takes Simcoe about 4 to 6 hours to paint. "This thing took me twice that, but mostly because of the paint," she said. "It's a lot of work, but it was fun." Traditionally, using water, mixable oil paints, and being unfamiliar with fabric paint, Simcoe painted the chair twice, and the first time resulted in paint soaking into the fabric. "It does make it a little harder than the nice, comfy chair that it once was," she said, "but I don't know that many people that would spend that much time sitting in it anyway. In my view," this is written by Don Brown, a compromise to reach immigration solution. Your characterization of the Gang of Eight proceedings in 2013 suggests that uncompromising Republicans were solely responsible. Pepper spray, Grijalva, and what really matters, page A6 on December 10th. However, the 2013 bill contained numerous problematic features. In fact, the bill would have been granted broad amnesty and facilitated further illegal immigration. For instance, widely publicized media summaries of the bill claim that background checks to screen out individuals with criminal records in their home countries were nullified by provisions that granted application approval and legal status in the United States authorities failed to respond within 48 hours. Considering the improbability of a timely response, or any response at all, from the applicant's home country, such as Honduras or El Salvador, the claim that criminals would be screened out was false. Republicans negotiating were confronted with this and other such provisions, ultimately withdrew from the negotiations. Therefore, the bill and subsequent attempts were essentially amnesty disguised as a means to cover for a significant increase in illegal immigration. The 1986 bill, signed into law by Reagan, was intended to be followed by stringent provisions to prevent future illegal immigration. However, this never materialized. Instead, elements from both the left and the right conspired to ensure the flow of immigration continued. For example, employment checks for legal residency and work authorization were deliberately designed to be easily circumvented. Barriers were erected to prevent checking with federal and or state agencies to verify legality. For instance, checking for valid security numbers, visas, or with ICE was prohibited. Even a simple utility bill with a local address was deemed sufficient. Open borders are no longer acceptable as they were in the 1800s and earlier. Why? Milton Friedman argued that we can have open borders and a weak social welfare system, or we can have a robust social welfare system with controlled immigration, but not open borders with generous welfare support. Given the increasing generosity of our welfare system, including payments to illegal immigrants, controlling immigration is now essential. The aggressive deportation policies of the current administration have become feasible only because the previous administration encouraged illegal immigration by opening the borders excessively, disregarding the legal system and providing aid to individuals entering the country illegally through payments to NGOs and even government flights. Over 10 million people entered, straining budgets at local, state, and federal levels. This influx created the current consensus for aggressive deportation. That we didn't need new immigration laws to stop the flood of illegals became obvious when the new administration simply enforced existing laws and halted the flood. However, a long-term solution to the millions of illegals currently residing in the United States would be desirable. After deporting more than 10 million people Biden allowed in during his administration, a compromise that would address the remaining illegal population is needed. This compromise involves granting a one-time special status to qualified individuals, allowing them to remain in the country legally but without a pathway to citizenship and therefore no right to vote. To qualify, individuals would have been in the country for years, have established roots, that is, jobs and families, not be accessing welfare, and have no criminal record here or in their home country. The key is that those who accept this status would forego any future options to become full voting citizens. The proposal will upset many on the right who want all of those here illegally to be deported. It will also disappoint many on the left who had high hopes of influencing future decisions and elections with a large number of new voters. However, this transition could benefit many individuals who have been in the country for years or even decades by granting them legal status. This would enable them to work openly, preserve the integrity of their families and lives, and ensure their long-time well-being. Country Fair White Elephant thrift store leaders handed out checks totaling more than $1.7 million to public and private schools, charities, law enforcement agencies, scholarships, and many other youth and nonprofit groups, and all at its annual event on Thursday at GVR's West Center. The celebration showcased and honored Santa Cruz Valley's many charitable organizations along the I-19 corridor and beyond. Schools received $527,000 in grants. The White Elephant, with about 400 volunteers, parceled out the grants after receiving about 140 applications. Larry Pisakin, White Elephant Executive Board Member with the Distribution Committee, said that the White Elephant has raised nearly $40 million through store sales since it opened in 1964. The store depends on community donations and is a popular stop for bargain shoppers all across southern Arizona. Officials with U.S. Immigration Customs Enforcement were stationed on Thursday near the Deconcini, port of entry, in a pedestrian area travelers used to cross into Mexico. Some travelers took to social media in the morning and throughout the afternoon, stating that ICE officials also were present at the Mariposa port of entry. According posts on a few local Facebook groups, people said ICE officials were asking for documentation, taking photos, and asking extensive questions. The breadth and reason of the ICE operation was unclear. Spokeswoman for the agency didn't immediately respond to requests for any information. ICE officials did not appear to be questioning everybody that was headed to Mexico at the Deconcini port. A Hispanic reporter with the Nogales International was asked for documentation as she tried to cross through Deconcini into Mexico. An Anglo reporter crossing later was not asked for documentation, but was questioned about his occupation, what he was doing there, and what brought him to Nogales. A reporter saw one person who appeared headed into Mexico patted down by ICE agents, and online chatter on Friday indicated the agents were still at the port. Canoa Ranch and Torres Blancas Golf Clubs went on the online auction block on Monday in 2 days of bidding that will end Wednesday morning. The bidding started at $500,000 and was at $1.25 million on Tuesday, with the required bid increment dropping from $250,000 to $100,000. The courses were listed on October 29th on the website Crexie.com. The sale includes the leased restaurant space at Torres Blancas and all other buildings, including Grill on the Green restaurant at Canoa Ranch. It also includes water rights and additional income from cell tower leases. Andy Orifice, whose family LLC has owned the courses for 11 years, said they are selling because they live out of state, and while he loves playing golf, I'm not in the golf course business, and neither are they, he said of the family. His father, Paul Orifice, who lived in Arizona and handled the courses, died about a year ago. Orifice said his dad had been working on selling both courses for several years through private brokers. We had a lot of people come through and look at them over the years, he said on Monday. According to the auction site, the courses have seen 7.5% to 9.5% revenue growth since 2021. Orifice said the restaurants have been a bigger challenge. He said deeds and restrictions don't allow development on the golf course sites, and he hasn't considered it. It's not being marketed as a redevelopment community. It's being marketed as buying two golf courses, he said. Mike Cochran, manager of the club since 2016, said both are partially in floodplains. Cochran said he's willing to stay on a short time and help the new owner transition before he retires. Canoa Ranch opened in 2003. Torres Blancas opened in 1995. And there are 8 golf courses from Suarita to Tubac, and about 60 in southern Arizona. Andy Orifice said part of the proceeds will go to Purdue University. From Washington, U.S. House Republicans released a health care bill on December 12th. They hope it will help to curtail rising costs, although the measure doesn't have the level of Democratic support needed to get it through the Senate. The 111-page bill will likely move into the House floor next week, where Speaker Mike Johnson will need nearly every one of his members to vote to pass the legislation, an uphill battle given the vastly different views from among centrist and far-right members of the party on health care issues. Johnson said the bill offers clear, responsible alternatives that will lower premium costs and increase access and health care options for all Americans. Democrats have been pressing for a three-year extension of the enhanced tax credits for people who purchase their insurance through the Affordable Care Act marketplace. So far, House and Senate Republican leadership hasn't gotten on board with any extension of these subsidies, arguing that they have led to a sharp rise in the cost of health insurance. GOP lawmakers have instead pursued their own legislation, but without at least some backing from Democrats, no bill will make it through the Senate's 60-vote procedural hurdles. Arrests in the United States have fallen to the lowest level in decades, according to a new report that reconstructs national arrest trends in the absence of federal data. Council on Criminal Justice, a nonpartisan think tank, on Thursday released the first comprehensive national analysis of arrests since federal authorities stopped publishing detailed arrest statistics in 2020. Arrests plunged during the first year of the pandemic and have remained low, according to the analysis. The national arrest rate in 2024 was 30% below the 2019 level, 71% lower than the peak in 1994. Drug arrests have fallen even faster, with adult and juvenile drug offense rates dropping to about half of what they were in 2019. In 1980, juveniles made up nearly a fifth of all arrests nationwide, but by 2018, their share had fallen to 7%. And while adult arrest rates declined 7% between 2020 and 2024, juvenile rates rose 14% over the same period. Gender patterns have shifted as well. With arrests of men falling more steeply over time, women now account for a larger portion of arrests. Adult women share nearly doubled between 1980 and 2020, rising from 14 to about 27%. Girls' share of juvenile arrests grew from 18% to roughly 31%. Between 2020 and 2024, arrest rates for black and Asian juveniles surged 48% and 45% respectively, compared with an 11% increase among white youth. Rates for American Indians and Alaska Native juveniles fell by 4%. Among adults, arrests decreased by 12% for black people, 18% for Asian people, but declined by 10% for white adults and 17% for American Indian and Alaska Native adults. And that's the reading of the Green Valley News. Mark DeGroft with you this morning. Thanks for listening. I'll be back on Friday. Till then, take care.